This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 86th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Wenyuan Zhu, who is an assistant professor of computer science and engineering at the University of South Carolina. Her research runs the gamut of security and privacy in wireless devices and includes consumer-grade wireless systems that we all count on to work. Dr. Zhu received a career NSF award in 2009, the same year that she published Securing Emerging Wireless Systems. Wenyuan has a BS in electrical engineering with highest honor and an MS in computer science and engineering from Zhejiang University near Shanghai in eastern China, and a PhD in electrical and computer engineering from Rutgers. She lives in Columbia, South Carolina. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And you have a PhD from Rutgers. So the first question is, what made you decide to come to the United States for your postgraduate work?
I've been wanting to come to U.S. Ever since I was in college, mostly because I know that U.S. offers the best graduate education, research atmosphere is good. So I want to explore new things, and also I want to have a change of my life. Moving to a different country sounds like something fun and
adventurous. It's certainly a big adventure and quite a big culture change. How old were you when you started thinking about that as a possibility?
Probably in my teenager year, probably around 18. Once I get into college, then actually my mom had a big influence on me. She worked for Zhejiang University, and she talked with a lot of professors there. Mm-hmm. And those professors visited U.S. and they told her stories, what like is in the United States. And she passed that information along to me.
I see.
And yeah, so I was just thinking, I have to go there to see.
Cool. And your MS is from Zhejiang in China. Can you briefly describe the similarities and differences between Chinese technical culture and U.S. technical culture?
When I was in my master's degree, I don't consider I was doing research, although at the time maybe I thought I was.
I see.
I would say that I was doing a lot of engineering work. So there's a lot of real systems need to be done. Maybe because at the time I was a master's student, I was not a PhD student. So my advisor at that time didn't put me on real hardcore technical stuff.
Uh-huh.
But once I am in the United States, Wade Trappi, my PhD advisor, he actually gave me gadget. I love gadget.
Right. So you started working on real systems and getting your hands dirty, so to speak.
Right. Yeah. So he gave me stuff, say, hey, go, try to figure out how this thing works. And he actually, bought a few different type of gadgets, sometimes sensors, sometimes software defined radios. And I was always happy to learn how to program them. And actually, the funny story is once I was carrying on my gadget, planned to do experiment, and I was in the elevator. At the time, I think an elevator repairman, he was carrying a similar stuff what I was carrying. I think he probably think I'm doing the same work as he did.
Right. You could have. Did you try hacking the elevator? Why not?
No, because I was in it.
I don't know if that stopped you before. We'll get to that later.
So,
unlike yourself, who is a hardware person and a gadget person, I'm only a software guy. And in software security, we make an important distinction between bugs, which are defects found at the implementation level, you know, like on line 42, and flaws, which are defects found at the design level. And it strikes me that much of your research focuses on flaws at the design level. Would you think that's a fair characteristic?
Yeah, I think yes. Instead of saying flaws, I would consider that's more like a neglection.
Mm-hmm.
So when they designed the system, they didn't consider, hey, should we consider whether the system is secure or not?
Right.
Most of the time, their goal is, let's make this work.
Right.
So our boss is happy and we can make money.
Right. So let's dig into an example, maybe your work on securing car sensor networks through the tire pressure monitoring system. So that focuses on design issues, or maybe what you might call a flaw that would be just forgetting to put something into the design to deal with security. So can you tell us a story about that work, which incidentally has been covered in a couple of videos that you can watch on the net for listeners out there?
Yeah, sure. That was a fun project. It all starts, we know that wireless communication is vulnerable to eavesdropping. Somebody can just listen to it, can send message to impersonate someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So at a time when we know that car manufacturers plan to add wireless component into sensors, control unit, we were instantly thinking, okay, there must be something there. Let's dig in. We found out that the tire pressure monitoring system was the first mandatory systems. So pretty much all cars after 2007 will have it. At the time, I just graduated, so I got a new car. perfect timing. And so my student and I and also our collaborators, and we started to work on it. And we reverse engineer the communication protocol, and then we managed to eavesdrop my cars.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so I use my car as the experiment tool.
See, so I don't see why you didn't just hack the elevator too, but whatever.
Well, that's not mine.
Oh,
maybe I should purchase one.
Buy an elevator. I like it. You've also done some work on automatic meter reading systems for electricity and gas meters. Tell us about that work a little bit.
Yeah, that's all starts and when everybody talks about smart meters. At time we were thinking, what about now? Smart meters might be something implemented somewhere as a pilot project.
Mm-hmm.
It may happen in the future, but what's going on now? So we walk around, we know there's this type of meter called AMR meter, automatic meter reading system.
Mm-hmm.
And so again, we start to reverse engineer the communication protocol and found out that all the message was sent out in plain text.
Wow.
So
all you really needed was just a little antenna to eavesdrop.
Right. You need an antenna, and we use software-defined radio so that we can program the radio to interpret the transmission from the meters.
Mm-hmm.
So we actually managed to receive meter readings from a single location, and we collect up to 500 meter readings. 500 different types of meter.
So you could detect a neighborhood's worth of meters.
Yeah, let me correct myself. We actually managed to collect over 500 meters in one of our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And we managed to find out the working pattern, daily routine of one of our neighbors. When he gets up, when he goes to work,
right. When
he comes back.
Right.
So it was a little bit surprising.
I suppose you might be able to change people's bills, too, by making it appear that they're using no electricity, although you were just eavesdropping in this case.
We could. We did it in the lab. So we have our own readers. But we don't have the big collector that utility companies use.
Mm-hmm.
I think theoretically we can. We actually plan to do that, and then we think, okay, we shouldn't do that. Otherwise, once the bill comes, that's an evidence of a crime. We don't want to go that far.
So what was the reaction of the meter people to this problem when it got revealed?
So there's actually different reaction. At first, we contact the utility companies. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not happy, and they were surprised, and they actually offered to buy me out, actually. Hmm. I was too stubborn at the time. I could have retired earlier, right?
Yeah, who needs tenure?
And then later, I actually met one kind of researcher in a security lab in a media company. He was very cooperative. He considered that's great work. That's exactly what research community should do, and what they should do to, like, together we should improve the security mm-hmm. of the metering system.
So did you do that? Did you end up working together on that?
So yes, we ended up, right now we're doing paperwork. Once the paperwork is done, I will receive meters donated by the meter company. Mm-hmm. And then we will continue working on analyzing the security and maybe privacy issues on the meters.
Very good. So I think it's important to emphasize now at this point in our conversation that though some of your work has been breaking stuff in a spectacular fashion, a lot of your research has to do with building stuff properly in the first place. So, for example, your research into anti-jamming at the link layer goes, you know, well past the usual magic crypto fairy dust approach. And it's a positive thing in a sense that designers can use that sort of technique to anticipate and then mitigate security problems during design. So where do you anticipate that the anti-jamming link layer stuff might end up being used in practice?
So I hope that, so it's a good question. At the time when we were thinking, okay, how we should design the system so maybe the industry will adopt it, mm-hmm. we didn't really think, let me put it this way. We have our own view on what is practical.
Right. And as academics.
Right, from the academic perspective. And I'm pretty sure from the company or industrial perspective, they have their different view.
Right.
So it's a little bit hard for me to say where exactly they may adopt it. Mm-hmm. But I hope, let's say, in regular consumer product, like in the popular ISM band, like 2.4 gigahertz, any device that work on in that band, mm-hmm. If they can adopt our technique, that will be great. Mm-hmm. But I'm open to listen to critiques on which assumption was not practical from the industry point of view.
Well, there are more and more things hopping into that bandwidth, so I think there's a lot of possibility there. We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. You and I met in Ann Arbor last month at the Archimedes Medical Device Workshop that Kevin Fu put together. Tell us how your research on wireless communication and jamming and radar and all that stuff relates to medical devices.
So a lot of the implantable medical devices use wireless communication to exchange information. Well, I guess it's not convenient to put a wire out of a human body and hook it up to a computer.
Yeah, run around with a computer attached to yourself.
Right. So it's natural to use wireless technology. And with wireless technology, there's a few known vulnerability or risks. I think from my perspective, I hope in the future when companies design implantable medical devices, they should consider to at least to cover those common known risks.
Right.
And so, for instance, eavesdropping and injecting spoofed fake message, mm-hmm. those, and also maybe the availability issue, like what if the device is being jammed and it cannot communicate? So there should be some fail-safe, like a technique to cope with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's from the wireless communication aspect. Now, one of our recent work actually look at using wireless, so basically using radio signal as an interference source, mm-hmm. as an intentional interference source to change the analog sensor readings. So for instance, with cardiac devices, let's say a pacemaker, most of the time there is a sensor measuring what is the heartbeat rhythm right
through
now.
Electrical impulse probably.
Right, right. So the so we actually recently we managed to send out carefully crafted intentional radio signal
mm-hmm.
to let the sensor pick up a heartbeat, which was caused by our signal, but not with heart.
Even though there wasn't a heartbeat necessarily.
Right.
Yeah. So I suppose you could cancel out a standard heartbeat too if you needed to.
That might be tricky to do. Yeah, I think probably theoretically maybe it's possible.
Uh-huh.
Our work just to show that with analog sensors, we should test whether the data is trustworthy.
Right.
Whether
right.
the data is really coming from what it's supposed to.
Right. Maybe do some anomaly detection or other signal analysis, I suppose.
Right, maybe do some consistency check,
mm-hmm.
maybe, and so actually we have one solution is we can actually ping the heart just to find out the heartbeat was just measured, is that really coming from the heart,
hmm.
or it's from external interference source.
Hmm. Sounds worrisome. So, kind of a meta question, when it comes to design, do you think that electrical engineering is, in some sense, more advanced than computer science is as a discipline?
You mean in terms of, in general, the design?
Yeah, in terms of thinking about possibilities and thinking about failure conditions and, yeah.
I will say probably computer science is more advanced in, okay. So
really? That's terrible to know. Darn.
Okay, let me be careful here. So I think in terms of dealing with unintentional, in dealing with safety issue,
yeah.
I think EEE, electrical engineer, they've been very careful on that.
Okay.
But when they, I don't think they paid enough attention to intentional attacks
or
risks. So they're looking at safety, but not security.
Right. Yeah, those two are related in a really peculiar fashion because, in some sense, a security issue can cause a safety problem. And often safety problems are just a result of environmental issues or whatever, sunspot activity. But if an attacker can figure out how to make that happen on purpose, then you can cause the same sort of failure from a security perspective.
Right. So most of time, safety deal with that like unintentional condition.
Mm-hmm.
But security deal with a bad guy and purposely try to explore, is there anything they can do to penetrate a system?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking that maybe the answer might be EE, just in a sense that hardware is slightly more expensive to manufacture, so you try to get it right the first time. To a greater extent than software people who sort of sloppily just try to hack along until it compiles.
It is indeed harder to modify hardware, but I know during the design phase of hardware, they also do like arrow and try.
Mm-hmm.
So they will produce a board, and then they will debug it. And then
right.
if some part of the circuit is not correct, they redesign the whole thing and make a new one, and then do the debugging again.
Sure. So it's very much more similar to the software situation.
Right.
And
yeah,
I guess the other thing to think about there is that much hardware today is built in software, and then you compile the design down before you print the chip anyway.
Right.
It's
well,
all.
I'm not an expert in that. I just know a little bit on how hardware is made.
Yeah, I was just thinking about VLSI, for example. Another topic. You've sort of overcome, if that's the right word, it's a little too strong, but two major obstacles to become an academic in the United States. One, you're from China, and two, you're also a woman. So why are there so few women in computing, and what can we do about it? And how would you relate, you know, gender stuff with culture stuff?
Okay, wow. It's a big question. The short answer will be, I don't know. Well, but I can talk about my personal experience.
Sure.
So when I was in college, we have like 87 students, and there were 8 female.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the reason it happened at that time is probably most of the time women are labored as doing non-engineer work.
Mm-hmm.
They should not go to like a math, physics. They should go into like social work, mm-hmm, or humanity. So that's like the perception. I mean, perception on what a woman should do.
Even in China, because it's the same in the United States, sadly.
Right. Yeah. So I think maybe a simple way is to change the image, like the association, what women are supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I think probably a few years ago, there's this Bobby Dow. I think that.
That's right. The math class is hard, Barbie. Who was also going to be a doctor. I'm going to be a doctor, but math class is hard. It's like, well.
Right, right. So yeah. We can put, I think in 2010, like over half a million Barbie fans say, oh, they want to see a Barbie dressed in computer engineer clothes. So I think those things are positive.
What are computer engineer clothes? Are they just like ill-fitting clothing? I mean, how with bad style? How does that work?
No, so I think they build a T-shirt, uh-huh, with a binary pattern on it.
Awesome.
And the Barbie were holding a laptop.
Right, right, right.
Right. So I just sending out the image, and I think having more women in like a faculty position, in teaching position,
mm-hmm,
and let them like being the messenger to tell the other girls, hey, if we can do it, you can do it.
Yeah, so you lead by example to some extent.
Right.
Do you have any female students now?
I have one.
Uh-huh.
Interestingly, I try very hard to recruit more female students.
Yep.
But only recently I was successful.
Yeah, we have trouble here. We proactively go out and try to find women at Sigital. You know, we've got 250 people, but we still have a very difficult time attracting women because they're just not enough in computer science.
Mm, yeah, that's not enough. I think that's the problem.
Yeah.
But actually, when I was in graduate school, my advisor, he had like an army of female students.
Uh-huh.
There was actually one day he was sitting in his chair right after meeting. All of us line up and wait to meet with him. And then he was like shocked because there's basically 5 female students waiting in line,
right,
to
right,
talk to him.
Right.
That was not usual, but I guess hopefully that can be a reality in the future.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
All other people.
So one last question is kind of a funny question. I have to preface this last question with some disclosure. So I grew up in a state called Tennessee, which is in the South, and now I live in Virginia. And the question is, what is the quirkiest and silliest aspect of South Carolina culture that you've noticed?
Okay, you're asking a dangerous question. So hopefully.
Always.
Hopefully, I don't upset a lot of people in South Carolina. I think in South Carolina, the football game,
mm-hmm,
is so big. Okay, so maybe I shouldn't use that. Okay, let me change to another thing. Okay, so let me make fun of food then.
No. Football culture is okay. I think that's found all over the United States, though. You'll find that in Michigan and other places as well.
Well, so sometimes what I don't understand is, I'm not a football fan, so
yeah.
What I don't understand is people will drive like 2 hours, 1 hour,
yeah,
to go to a football game, but they don't enter the stadium.
they just sit in the parking
park
lot.
There, yes, watch the TV and then doing barbecue. So
I love it. That's called tailgating, and that is definitely a pretty crazy American phenomenon.
Right, but if you're driving 2 hours, you'd better go into the stadium, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Good one. Yeah. That's a good one. Well, thanks. This has been an interesting conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. Oh, by the way, a tiny correction.
Uh-huh.
Now I am an associate professor.
Ah,
no
cool.
longer an assistant.
Congratulations. So you had your tenure go by. Super.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Great. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital, an IEEE security and privacy magazine, and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April issue of IEEE S&P features special coverage of technology transfer, as well as our interview with Steve Belevin, who's currently the CTO of the Federal Trade Commission. See www.computer.org/security for more. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.